Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Coding 101 is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Coding 101 is brought to you by Lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit Lynda.com/C101. That's Lynda.com/C101. And by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for the right payments API, check out the Braintree V.0 SDK. With one simple integration, you get every way to pay. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/coding. On this episode of Coding 101, we're finishing up the TWiT API. Welcome to Coding 101. It's TWiT's programming show where we let you into the wonderful world of the code monkey slash code warrior. I'm Father Robert Palliser, and standing next to me is, again, our in-house guru, Mr. Patrick Delahanty. Patrick, thank you for coming back on.
Oh, my pleasure. I love being on this show.
Now, you're here because we are doing one last week of the TWiT API.
Yes.
It's actually been instrumental. If you've seen the TWiT TV website, it's running on the API. And we've actually opened it up so that people who want to code applications that take advantage of TWiT content, they can now do it.
Yeah. People have done TWiT apps for years, and now we're finally giving them a tool they can use to make these apps even better with more up-to-date information.
Right. I'm going to make this default disclaimer at the very beginning, and we'll do it again at the end. If you see an API key during this show, we delete it. We actually created a set of keys that we would just dispose of as we did the episodes. So if you download code and you find an API key, don't try to use it because it's not going to work. Because you could just get your own. And Patrick, where do they get an API key?
Go to twit.tv, go to the About section, and you will see development information. And on that page, we have links to Apiary, where you can find the documentation. And there's also a link to Threescale, where you can sign up for your own API key.
Right. And the reason why you want your own API key and the reason why you want to keep your API key secret for you is because it's limited to 5 hits per minute. And if you hand out your API key to a lot of people and they are using yours to hit the TWiT API, then your requests will probably not go through. It's just, it's one of the things. It doesn't hurt us, but we don't like our users having API keys that don't work properly. And you're pretty generous with the keys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as long as they have a valid email address, then they're pretty much good to go.
There we go. Speaking of good to go, we have the third member of this module of Coding 101, the one, the only, the incomparable, Lou Maresca, a senior software lead for Microsoft. Lou, thank you for coming back on.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Now, you're still up in Redmond. Our guest who will be coming in, David Deers from Four Kitchens, is down in Austin. We've got a nice representation of sort of this coast.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Technology hubs in the States.
Now, before we get back into the TWiT API and David Deers, who's going to let us into sort of the what do you call it, inside baseball, behind the scenes information about how that was developed, we do want to talk about something that you found of interest this week, and that is programmers being used for animation.
Yeah, so I think there's something really cool is Pixar came out with a really neat course with Khan Academy just recently where they'll actually take you through the production and the challenges behind production of creating an animated film. But this also kind of rolls over slightly to coding too, because the idea of producing an animated film also pertains to producing a game too. So if you actually want to develop a game, the whole idea, and this goes through many challenges. It goes through, you know, how they, you know, come up with the story and how they do modeling and animation and how they go through the rendering mathematics, and they go through a whole ton of things. And it's kind of a bootstrap to really getting your juices flowing when it comes to learning how to animate and build animation, as well as even game development.
You know, it's interesting because there is a movement to bulk up on STEM. That's science, technology, engineering, and math. And this is one of those areas where you can push STEM even though they don't really know you're pushing STEM. The concept is, look, that the stuff that you're learning that you think is going to be useless once you get out of high school or university, actually applies if you want to do something cool like creating animation from Pixar, something that you might see in Monsters, Inc. Is that sort of the vein that they're going for, you know, Khan Academy and others like them?
Yeah, absolutely. They're trying to use common areas that people know about and really love, like Pixar. You know, people love their movies, and they use that to kind of bootstrap the whole concept of how to get yourself into doing math more, how to take concepts of real world concepts and create them in the virtual world, that kind of thing. I think it's just a really good. I mean, I started taking the course, and it's a really good course. I mean, it does show you some in depth look in the Pixar process, and it'll take you into some of the non-technical things, like, you know, the whole concept between what they call uncanny valley, where, you know, if you create an animation where it really looks like a human, it can actually stir up some emotional feelings of people and how they feel about things. And so, like, that's it's kind of a really cool course.
The uncanny valley is one of my favorite paradigms. And the idea, of course, is if you start here, where this line is how comfortable people are with what you've created, and this line is how close it is to being human. As you go up and you get closer and closer and closer to it looking real, people are more comfortable until you get right before it. So right before it becomes real, but not quite there, and suddenly the comfortability drops. And it's this weird human psychology. We don't actually understand yet what the other side of the uncanny valley is yet, because we have not gotten to the point where we create something that looks absolutely real, that you cannot tell apart from being manufactured. So I know this has nothing to do with the Coding 101 episode we're talking about right now, but yeah, I love the uncanny valley. You know what? We're going to do a future episode on the uncanny valley. I don't know how, but we're going to do it.
Sounds good. Absolutely.
Patrick, let me bring you in on this, because we're talking about animation. And of course, animation is going to use math. It's going to use concepts of space and volume. You have to have that if you want to do something like a Monsters, Inc. But that's not the only place where you'll use basic concepts, because what we're talking about is a very fundamental process of programming. That is taking something from the real world, breaking it down into its component parts, and then coming up with individual solutions for those problems.
Yeah. Yeah. There's not a question.
No, but, no. How much of that do you do when you do, say, the daily programming on the TWIT website?
Well, I just have to look at the task as a whole and see what the overall problem is and figure out the component parts and figure out the code that I would need to solve each of those parts and make it productive. So, like, as I rewrite part of our encoding engine, this is the part that encodes the episode. But then there's also processing the data that I pull in through the API, and then there's publishing it to our CMS, and then there's pushing it to the website and YouTube and Spotify and everything. And so each of those is its own little process that I have to figure out how that component works.
Right.
And so,
right. Lou, I want to let you finish up this banter, because it is interesting that what you found, the development tool that people can download right now if they want to start playing with. Can you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, so one of the things I wanted to point out too is, you know, this is a course about building an animation, you know, animation movie, but the concepts, like I said, roll over to building games. So I wanted to give some examples around some of the platforms out there that it can kind of get you into gaming development. So one of the biggest ones today that people are really talking about is the Unity Engine graphics development platform, and it's a way to go build not only 2D games but also 3D games. And in fact, there's some great courses out there for you to kind of bootstrap and get into learning how to do those things and even build your own kind of Flappy Bird type game. So, you know, check out Unity, and that's a really good place. There's some digitaltutors.com has some really good examples there. Also, if you wanted to build for Android, there's a site called Kilobolt, and they have a game development site that actually walks you through building Flappy Bird for Android, which is kind of cool. And it'll go through the steps of, you know, not only learning Java, it'll start from the very beginning, but it'll walk you through kind of like, you know, using the tutorials to kind of make different parts of the game and that so on and so forth. But, you know, really getting into the Unity engine and there's another one called the Unreal Engine. Unity is good for like mobile development, iOS. It's good for Android, Windows Phone, Mac, PS3, Xbox, you name it, a Unity engine works on it. So learning that will help you kind of understand the concepts that really game corporations use to kind of get into that. And so these are all things that will get you really interested in and get you started in that industry.
Well, gentlemen, this is fun, but I want to jump into the API. We've got one last go. We're going to be speaking with David Deers from Four Kitchens, who is a maestro, literally a maestro. He's a musician and an engineer and a programmer and all those other good things rolled into one. I consider him the guru of the TWT API. He's going to let us behind the scenes to show us what goes into creating something like the TWT API. But before we go there, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the first sponsor of this episode of Coding 101, and it's got to be lynda.com. Now, lynda.com is your one-stop shop for knowledge. No matter what it is, no matter if you want to add to your business skills, or perhaps you want to learn new skills to help with your next job, or perhaps you need a reference to point back to things that you've already learned but need a refresher course for. Well, that's exactly what lynda.com is built for. Lynda.com has everything you need to feed that curious mind. Some of the latest lynda.com courses that I can recommend are Improving Visual Force Performance, Debugging the Web, JavaScript, Java Essential Training, and Adding Google Maps to Android Apps. Now, there are also multi-part series on Visual Studio 2015, Essentials and Database Fundamentals. And there's also a new course on creating audio apps for iOS. Lynda.com has become, well, it's a daily resource for me. Not only do I get to scroll through the courses and maybe find something that I didn't even know I wanted to learn, but it's a reference. So if I need help with stabilizing my photography when I'm flying my drones, or perhaps I need to have a reference to some Adobe Premiere Pro features so that I can get my next project to look just right, that's what lynda.com is built for, and that's what lynda.com is great for. Now, with a lynda.com membership, you can watch and learn from top experts who are passionate about teaching. You can stream thousands of video courses on demand and learn on your own schedule. You can learn at your own pace. Courses are structured so that you can watch them from start to finish or consume them in bite-sized pieces. And as a lifelong teacher, I know that if you give your student the ability to learn the way that he or she learns best, that's the best way to learn. You can also take notes as you go and refer to them later. You can browse the course transcripts so you can jump to individual pieces of videos rather than having to watch an entire video to find the one missing chunk of knowledge that you might need in your reference. You can download tutorials and watch them on the go on your iOS or Android devices. And you can create and save playlists and share them with your friends so that they can enjoy your love of knowledge. Lynda.com will change the way you think about knowledge, and, well, that's a good thing. Here's what we want you to do. We want you to try lynda.com. Your lynda.com membership gives you unlimited access to training on hundreds of topics, all for one low, flat rate. Whether you're looking to become an expert, you're passionate about a hobby, or you just want to learn something new, I want you to visit lynda.com at lynda.com/C101 and sign up for your free 10-day trial. That's lynda.com, lynda.com/C101. And we thank lynda.com for their support of Coding 101. We welcome back to the show Mr. David Deers from Four Kitchen. He's an engineer slash musician slash all-around cool guy down in Austin. David, how hot is it down there right now?
It was in the hundreds this past weekend.
So it's definitely it's an indoor time of year, I'd say.
I would say it's pretty cool, actually, given...
Wait, what? They grow them better.
Given the range of things that it could be, maybe it's okay.
Now, we had you on 2 weeks ago, but before the Labor Day break, and you were talking about how the API was made. What process goes in to migrating something like we had? Which let's be nice, Patrick. How would you describe what we had before Four Kitchens came in?
It was kind of a mess.
Hot mess. Yeah. I'd say hot mess. It was something that started off as basic Drupal installation, but then over the years had stuff just added on top of it and added on top of it to the point where when Four Kitchens got it, it was a little bit of a mess, and they had to go through all of that, normalize the data, and give us an API. Now, David, for the folks at home, can you explain to them what it means that we have our front end completely disconnected from our back end?
Yeah. So in a typical maybe Drupal installation or a CMS installation, you would have a back end, a data store. In a typical Drupal installation, that's going to be directly connected. So the PHP code that accesses that data is part of the same set that creates the presentational front end that you visit when you go to the website itself. What's happening for you all right now in this kind of decoupled scenario is you have some code that's accessing your backend information through an API. And that front-end code is actually in an entirely different language. It's in Node.js and Dust.js. And it's just making API calls. Like anybody who goes through Threescale and applies for an API key, and that is granted by you all, does. So it's the exact same kind of call that's being made to the API. The API is returning that information, and then it's taking that information, figuring out what to do with it, how to display it, making choices there. But that's all completely separate from, you know, the content management part of the application.
All right. And Patrick, that enables us to make changes to the Twit website as we see fit.
Yeah, it's separated, so we don't have to worry about if it'll affect the Drupal backend or not. You can just make a change on the front. As long as it's pulling in the data, it's good.
All right. David, we've actually got a question here from a member of the audience, a noob coder in our chat room, who has been asking for a while. Actually, he asked even this last week, which was, why would I want to use the API? Why wouldn't I just scrape the site? And, okay, let's back up. Explain that. Why is it that I would want to use an official API rather than just writing a script to scrape the site over and over again? In his mind, he says, wait a minute, I can scrape the site as many times as I want. The API limits me to 5 requests per minute. Why would I go that way?
Yeah, I guess part of it's because the information is modeled in the API because it has, and we talked about this before, which was the idea of a REST API, the idea of a hypermedia enabled API where links are real and true, which means that data is connected. I guess in hard ways. So like shows are connected to episodes, people are connected to episodes. Topics are connected to episodes, and all that information is ready to be put into a data store or even just manipulated through navigating the API. Yes, there is a limit on the amount of calls you can make, but the richness of the data is really there in a way that a blob of information that you might scrape from a site or even the information that was available in RSS feeds, which was kind of the technology that people were using as a proxy API in the past for Twit, doesn't provide, isn't there, you know? You right. really have to apply a lot of human thinking about what does this mean? What is this piece of information? It's typically here and it's typically in this set of tags, but that might change at any time. In the API, that's a steady kind of attribute that will be there for the version of the API. You can always request a particular version of the API depending on support life cycles and so on and so forth. But basically, if it's there in the API, you can depend on it to be a specific type of information and to be at a specific location. Right. So I guess there's nothing preventing you from scraping
you can do
the site.
It. Yeah,
and,
you absolutely can.
If that gives you what you want, you know.
And the first time Patrick needs to change an element on the front page, it will stop working and you'll have to reprogram it. But Lou, we actually did this. When we were talking about the very first time we ever talked about APIs, you did it both ways. You actually accessed an API and you also did a scrape. Now, those are both valid. You can do that, but you've got your own thoughts about which one you should use.
Yeah, absolutely. Screen scraping is crazy because, like you said, as soon as they change something's very, very small. Like, for instance, I think we did it for our Santa's Little Helper episode where we actually were screen scraping retail data from one of the websites. I think it was
Best Buy, I think.
Newegg or something. Yeah. But yeah, the APIs are so much easier because, like you said, it's like David said, you have a model. You download it. You know that there's going to be a title. There's going to be specific attributes for that entity that you're downloading, and it will always be there as long as you're using that version of the API. And I love David's comment around supporting specific versions because, Microsoft being pretty old software company, we always have to support back support. Supporting applications on Windows 7 or Windows XP and stuff like that, APIs are the same thing. And you can get yourself into a long legacy of set of versions when it comes to APIs.
Yeah.
And I guess the one thing, that I forgot to mention, but is actually key here, is that, we're talking about a human being interpreting this information and programming towards it. an API is something that a machine can understand. Basically, the future space for APIs is that through a series of like data definition files and profiles, that machines basically understand what they're looking at, that they have kind of common elements, things that come out of like schema.org, or whole industries could standardize on typing information. And then profiles could bridge the gap between what is custom to, say, Twit's implementation versus another network. And machines, when machines understand information, then that, like, basically you can use common libraries that are out there to get functionality right out the bat, or maybe you don't even have to do very much programming whatsoever. Like, it just kind of knows what it has. And that's the richness that's enabled by kind of using APIs versus something that really depends on the coder's understanding and context, and their ability to understand that context and program towards that context, which may change as we stated.
Right. And actually, 8-Bit Steve in the chat room has a very good comment here. He says, look, the problem with scraping is that you're treating the GUI as a programmatic interface. It was never designed to be a programmatic interface. As you said, that's not what it does. It talks to people. It doesn't talk to other computers. So if you're going through the extra step of taking something that the machine uses and turns into something humans can understand and turning it back into something machines can understand, that's just an extra step that you really don't want to do. So, you know, noob coder, you're free. You can do it that way. But we're just saying you won't be happy. If you've got access to an API, do yourself a favor. Build yourself out a back end and do it that way. I mean, if you want to play with scraping, that's fine. It's just, again, the very first time we make a change, everything you've written will break. That's not a good way to make an app.
And using the API, you can actually get information that isn't on the Twit site, or at least is not easily accessible. For example, all the appearances of a guest. You have to go deep within the site, and I think it only displays fewer than the limit on that one page. So you'd have to make even more requests. You get it through the API, the limit is higher, so you get more results, and it's in data that's formatted that's going to be consistent.
Right.
So
right. All right, David, let's go ahead and jump back into it. We've got some more questions from the chat room that we'll answer a little bit later, but I do want to jump back into the Twit API, because you had a few other things that you wanted to show us. Last time you showed us how the data was structured, this time you actually want to show us some code.
Yeah, last time we got a chance to take a look at the API output versus the editorial interface and how those two were connected and editors might work exclusively with the editorial API or the editorial side, I'm sorry. And then we just did like a split screen. But what we didn't get a chance to look at, which I am regretful, but now I have a chance to redeem myself, is the code. And here it is in all its glory. Drupal is a PHP based CMS framework.
Can you increase font size just a little bit?
I surely can. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
Oh my goodness. Please. All right, things are getting big.
Nope, that's good. We can see it.
We're
now.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So this is PHP code. Drupal is a PHP based CMS. Drupal is sort of composed of what we call modules, and they're sort of contribution modules are supplied by the community or created by the community and contributed to by community members. So they'll have like maintainers. There will be one or two, maybe five people or something like that who have control over merging in code that is put up into issues to solve problems with the code. That's kind of how open source works. So Drupal doesn't differ in that way. But different pieces of functionality are created and maintained in what we call modules, and standard organization of sites have that put into a module or a folder called contrib, and you can see that there are a lot of modules here in Twit. So we're using a lot of contrib functionality. What we're using to drive the API is a module called the RESTful module, which was developed by Matteo Bosch from Lullabot and Gizra, who's Emitai, and they did a great job. It's a really fantastic module. It provides a lot of things out of the box, like for your API. Filtering comes in out of the box. But it's a developer-based module. So in some cases, Drupal is filled with things that provide UIs or what we call site building experiences, which are I log into Drupal and I'm able to click some checkboxes or type a few things into the interface, and then I have a new bit of functionality. RESTful being a developer module means that it provides a coding framework, basically an object-oriented framework for a developer like me to add modules to without kind of site building elements. So I really like it because I can be very, very efficient with object-oriented code in PHP through inheritance and abstraction and composition. So what we were able to do is, based on the RESTful module, we were able to create different plugins that we used. Drupal has a plugin system called CTools, which is Chaos Tools, which is made by Merlin of Chaos originally, and who's one of the developers. Everybody has a handle there on Drupal.org. So mine is the Bruce, I think, or Beauty Hammer. I don't know. I get confused. I can't remember. Anyway, but the point is that these modules... So we use the CTools plugin, which is a CTools module. So we add these plugins and that each of the endpoints that we see on the site. So if we pull back the API, here's the discovery resource, which is at the root. We can see things like tags, roles, topics, types. So these are all various endpoints. And if we go to one, you know, we did last week, but we'll just go to sponsors, say, or actually we'll go to shows, which will take a little bit of time. I'll go ahead and click on that. It's really the rendering that takes a bit of a moment. So we'll let that sort of chug along. But if we go back over here, we can see that we have all sorts of endpoints that kind of look like that. We've got credits, features, offers, pages, people, posts, you know, all the things that we just looked at are sort of represented by these different plugins. And if we take a look at shows, for instance, we can see that we have a folder structure that kind of represents the API version. We've got some plugin definition, which is, you know, pretty close to CTools and you know, isn't more meaningful than that. It's just how plugins are defined in CTools. So we basically give it a version. We tell it how we want it to authenticate, which is to use the three-scale authentication process. A little description which shows up on the discovery resource, and we tie it back to what we call an entity type, which is show over there. And we talked about entities last week and nodes and how nodes relate to entities in Drupal 7. And then, you know, basically what we want the resource to be titled. And so if it has sort of finished out rendering. So the resource is titled shows and produces a JSON listing-based endpoint here, which lists all of the shows that have ever been, you know, live for Twit and their information and ways to interact with them and go to detail pages, which have additional relationships and connect data through the Hadios HAL plus JSON API format that we've chosen. The actual, so we also point to the sort of the class file, which implements the RESTful module's, you know, kind of base entity representation. And it's in this piece of code that we define kind of the different attributes. So we have definitions for each of the properties there. And I will say that if you're interested in what's happening here and want to learn more, that that we have the Rest Easy series on Four Kitchens blog site, which is forward.fourkitchens.com. That's a weekly blog series which talks about how to use the RESTful module to produce a API just like Twit is using, basically. It's been a great... it was a great project to kind of run this module through its paces and to implement on top of it. And we, you know, being an open source development shop, and basically our mission is to set information free, you know, we want to give back to the community, and I know that Twit's in support of that. So, you know, we're using that information, using those experiences to kind of guide people through the creation of APIs using the RESTful module in Drupal. So if you are interested, please tune into that series. It'll be updated on Mondays. That's my little plug. But back to the code.
No, wait, no, I like the plug. I like the plug. Okay. That's a great plug.
And you did a presentation on that API module at DrupalCon, if I remember right.
I mentioned RESTful as one of the ways that APIs could be implemented. I did a presentation at DrupalCon LA, which was on API design. So if you wanted to get sort of a higher level when I'm thinking about implementing an API for my own site in Drupal, or when I'm thinking about, and this was actually outside of Drupal, it's just sort of general API design thoughts, what makes a good RESTful API. And how I did that was to kind of do a school. I have a master's degree in music composition, and it brings me a lot of joy in life to play music, and I really love to do it. So what I wanted to do was kind of marry my two interests together, which is code with music. So I thought I'd do a Schoolhouse Rock style educationally based presentation. It was kind of a departure from my typical presentation. So I created songs that were about API design, and hopefully it's a useful way to get some of those concepts stuck in your head. You know, I remember the noun song, verb song, conjunction, junction. There it is. So I played for a room full of coders, basically getting up there with a guitar. It was a really interesting gig. It was a really interesting presentation. It was a really interesting gig. So depending on
We'll ask this again at the end, but if they want to find your music and hear some of these songs, where can they go?
Yeah, to daviddiers.com. That's daviddiers.com. And there's links to my SoundCloud, and you can links to iTunes to buy it if you want to, or you can listen to the whole thing for free. So my EP, that is. And there's YouTube channels with some other kind of bluegrass stuff I've done more recently. So
yeah, Schoolhouse Rocks for the programming generation. I think, I'm in. All right. Okay. So jump us in. So now we understand how you're developing it. Show us exactly what's going on in the ethers.
Yeah. Okay. So, so here you can see, this is where we define the fields. This actually goes back to what we took a look at last week. So here we're talking about, we're giving new names, sort of semantic and abstracted names that aren't going to be, you know, tied to an implementation. One of the things you want to do with an API, you know, Patrick's mentioned, Padre, you've mentioned this as well, like one of the benefits of having a decoupled solution is that your front end is sort of free from the back end concerns, and you can like make a new version, you can make new visuals, you can have a really fresh site, because front end technology, we all know, is like iterating way faster than back end technology. It's a really exciting space, and people, when they interact with your site, they interact with the front end, and they, you know, the experience there is really important to keep fresh and new. So that's great. But the cool thing about an API based site, it actually, like the decoupled version, you're building to the API on the back end. So these things can change. You don't worry about the implementation. So we have all, like, you know, field names here that are, you know, Drupal 7 specific, that are implementation specific names for these things. But if you guys wanted to, for whatever reason, switch to Django tomorrow or switch to Node.js to provide this API, you could do that as long as you produce the exact same API. Like the API is the contract between the front end and the back end. So you're actually able to iterate on the back end as well, totally change entire technology stacks if it makes sense, as long as you're producing the same API output. So, that's kind of a neat thing, and it's also good API practice to like get away from exposing implementations for that reason. So as soon as you expose an implementation, like if my field name for show notes was field show default notes footer, then I basically would have coupled my implementation to the API, which would have been a bad mistake, because I'm always going to have to use that field name, you know, forever, right? Or something like that.
Do you purposely obfuscate your implementation just to make it not so easy to guess?
It's not about obfuscation. It's about not coupling implementation details.
Got it.
Right.
Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Because like this might come from a new thing called show notes, or a new field named show notes, or 176536. It doesn't matter. But I wouldn't want to like tie that to this thing, because if 175656 is no longer the name of the thing, but I've named it that, I always need to keep it that, even if it doesn't make sense anymore. So this is a really Drupal-ish kind of name. I just didn't want to expose that as the public-facing API name, because it is so Drupal-y, right?
Right. Well, so, David, what do you have planned next? I mean, because obviously we're going to want to grow this API. We had this discussion on an episode two weeks ago, where we talked about, well, where would we want to expand the TWT API? Would we need to ever expand the TWT API? This is a question that gets asked a lot when you do site development, which is, when can you say, okay, this is our standard, this is our normalized data, we're never moving from this, or you just put into the accounting for development cycles that eventually you're going to increase the API and you're going to functions, the calls, and you're going to have to change what you already have.
Yeah, where to go from here and how to account for that?
Yeah.
Versioning is a big part of that in APIs. So it is about, because when you have an API, when you have an interface, you hope that people are going to use that and that that will be substantial. So if someone builds an iTunes app or someone builds a Roku app or someone builds an Android app against this API and this specific version, it's a concern of lifecycle because even if you guys want to iterate and move forward, you would want to continue to support a specific version, you know, of the past. But luckily you sort of can do that. This module enables it, and many other API implementations enable you to have separate versions at the same time. So you can sort of keep the legacy version running, and then that's an agreement and messaging with your user community, like, hey, we'll keep this running for 2 years. I mean, it's you know, like Microsoft, eventually Windows 95 went away, right? But a lot of people were still using it into the audits and so forth. So people, once they implement against an API, they kind of expect that information to be there, and getting them to go back and change your code to the new version of the API is sort of like might not happen, maybe happen, could happen when they have time. So there is legacy support. But luckily you have a space to iterate on, like V1.1 or V1.2, where you could add new relationships between data in terms of what I see or in terms of what I – you know, if there were unlimited time, unlimited resources, what I would have hoped to do would provide more relationships between entities here, between endpoints, like richer Hadios relationships, I think is where it's really at, for expanding the Twit API. And we did add from release date to kind of the end of my engagement, we did add a new API endpoint, which was the streaming endpoint, which allows you to have, as an API consumer, have access to all of the live streams that are available for Twit. So that was something that we, you know, kind of iterated on. And you know, I assume that there's other kinds of spaces that can be explored and exposed through the API. So luckily, through kind of like having different versions and using a good versioning strategy, you can continue to innovate and iterate while still giving people the stability they need for the applications that they developed against your API.
So David, real quick, one quick question for me is, like, if you had a change, like for instance, if I wanted to add like a tweet, a hashtag for every show that I had, and I wanted to add that to the schema, like how easy would it be for you to do that, in the back end and then have it show up in the front end?
Yeah. So that's, I mean, you're basically looking at kind of going through Drupal interface here and adding a new field to a content type, which is something you can do in the UI. So let's say on episodes, if we just want to do this, is all local. I'm not going to be editing anything new. But if I went to the content type for episodes, went to manage fields, I could. It'll take some time, but basically, I can add a new field down here to represent hashtags. Once I've done that, I would go over to my code base. And on an episode, I would go to episodes. I would open up episodes in the public field space, which controls what comes out of the API. I would add that my field name. I would add that, you know, the property, basically be a simple field like this one. These other ones are sort of complex fields, maybe have references to other things, so they have a bit more attached to them. Add the actual field name, add the name that I want to expose to the API. I would probably version up the episodes because I'm adding something to 1.1. So I'd have 1.0, and I would add a new folder called 1.1 and sort of just have it inherit this class. Or use this class basically, and then add that new field. And there we go. That field would start showing up on the API at that point. I'd have to do some testing to make sure everything was cool and that it didn't break any front end implications. That's not very likely, but it's just, you know, what you do as a developer. So, but pretty easy to add something that simple. The relationships are a little bit harder, and I think that's where the really rich value comes out. But something like just adding a hashtag to episodes you know, super easy to do with this method. So this is why we like it. You know, we were able to stand up a lot of these endpoints, and there are quite a few, you know, pretty easily. The complexities came in like the relationships and formatting these things. But for something that's a text field, that's, you know, really going to come out pretty quickly. And then, you know, it's going to show up on the API here, you know, like something pretty simple, like type audio. Or it would say hashtags and then just have a value there. So pretty easy overall.
Cool.
We're speaking with David Deers from Four Kitchens. He is an engineer / musician. He is the, I'm going to say it, the man behind our API. I know there was other people on the team, but, you know, it's easy to identify it with you.
When I had questions about the API, I went to David.
You went to David. So. We're going to come right back. We're going to be speaking more with David. But first, I want to do take some time to stop for our second sponsor of this episode of Coding 101. And it's Braintree. Now, let me ask, you're all programmers here. At some point, you're going to want to add some sort of financial end on your application, right? I mean, let's be honest. No one's just going to write applications for the rest of their life without having some way to support themselves. Now, in the old day, that was easy. It was very fun. You had to develop some sort of relationship with a payment processor so that you could take credit cards, because you'd want to take credit cards. Then you'd have to worry about your back end, because you're responsible for people's personal information, and you don't want to lose it. That's a great way to go out of business. Oh, and of course, you're going to have to buy some hardware somewhere so that they could actually host the secure application that goes inside your service. That was fun, right?
Oh, yeah. I loved doing that.
Yeah. Everyone loved doing it. Of course, if you're one of the few people who don't like doing all that work, you just want to have an application that accepts payments really easily, well, that's why you go to Braintree. Braintree is code for easy online payments. If you're building a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, you need to check them out. You owe it to yourself to check them out. The Braintree V.0 SDK makes it easy to offer multiple mobile payment types. You can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo cards, and more, all with a simple 10-line integration. Oh, it's simple, secure payments, code that you can integrate in minutes. And if you're a developer, you don't have to worry about it because they've got really good documentation. I know this is a problem with some of these APIs, some of these packages that you fold into your service. They make you figure out what everything does. Not so with Braintree. Not only do they document everything, but if you're having a problem with integration, they'll have one of the representatives guide you through it. Hold your hand to make sure you do it right. They also have a sandbox so that if you want to test out your integration, make sure it's going to work, make sure it's not going to expose any customer information, well, you can do that too. Now, it uses tokenized information, which means no personally identifiable information is actually ever transferred over the internet unsecured. It's a great way to make sure that you're not accidentally going to open up your customers to a breach. And yeah, we know what that does to a business. Now, their code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients. They've got an SDK that does 7 different languages, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. And again, it's just 10 lines of in-app code. There's really no reason not to try Braintree. Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payment types with one integration. They've got quick, knowledgeable developer support if you've got any questions, and they let you accept all the payments that your customers, that your fans, that your clients want. With that Braintree V.0 SDK, one small snippet of code, and you're up and running in less than 10 minutes. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, like you needed another reason, go to BraintreePayments.com, BraintreePayments.com/coding. And we thank Braintree Payments for their support of Coding 101. We're back to David. David, we've got sort of a mini war that's brewing in our chat room right now. From some of our audience members, developers who are saying, look, we like the API. API is interesting. It's cool. It's an idea that its time has come because we want people to develop apps for Twit content. But they're upset with the API limit. They don't like the fact that they can only hit it 5 times every minute until it locks out that key until the next minute. We've been telling them that this is how a lot of APIs work. If you want to design something for yourself, that's fine. 5 requests a minute is not a problem. But if you're going to develop an app off of it, you're going to want to build yourself a back end. What's your take? Because you've done a lot more development than we have. We've only worked on the Twit website. What have you seen in your work experience about opening up APIs and where they can be abused or where they can be helpful?
Having an authenticated API is useful to understand patterns of use, to negotiate with users of VAPI to preference some, if that's what you want to do. I'm not saying that's happening for Twit, but I'm just saying as a practice, you know, that that's something that can happen. And in some cases is an interesting one. You know, there are monetized APIs out there that definitely rely on that. Limits are frustrating, or they can be. But the truth is that, you know, server resources are expensive, cost money. I mean, like, we all operate in a world where these kinds of things is real. Like, it's not invisible. There is a cost to being, to providing an API, to providing a pretty open API, to saying yes to everybody who wants to access the API. And that probably means that the trade-off is that there's some pretty maybe aggressive limits around the kinds of access you can have against an API. So, I definitely had, talked to, Leo and about this, and Patrick and basically everybody on the, and Bruce about, what it means to have an API available that probably do need to think about some limits around there, because without any limits, basically exposes resources that could suffer greatly, that might cost performance at some point down the chain. So it's all about like figuring out what that number is. Maybe it needs some tweaking. Maybe it's okay. Maybe the idea is that you ingest that API, build a backend, and have that information. You know, 5 a minute is workable. More is better. But yeah, like I said, we exist in a world where things cost money. So as much as it would be great to kind of open up everything, sometimes it's just not possible. So
yeah, and if somebody's got some code with a bug and they introduce an infinite loop and they're just slamming the API, it's good to have that limit in place so that we're not just getting hammered from somebody that's just an accident.
Right.
Yeah. Not even nefarious use, but just like, I didn't even realize that basically the way that I coded this was bringing, the API to a crippling halt. So
yeah, and I mean, everyone's done that because you do want to hit the API, right? Because you want to refresh your data, even, less so for an organization like Twit, because we do weekly shows or even daily shows for some of them. But if you've got an organization that is constantly refreshing, there is that temptation to just keep hitting the API, just keep hitting it. And that's fine if it's one person or two people. But if you've got 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 people hitting your API at the same time, and they're doing it multiple times a second, that's not insignificant. I mean, each API JSON that comes back is relatively small, but put enough of those together and suddenly you go down.
So if you're getting all the data for every episode of Security Now or something that's got thousands of, or I guess 1,500 episodes-ish is the most, with GizWiz is up there and TNT is up there.
Right.
Yeah. And so you're getting all the information from every episode that could easily add up.
Yeah. So, it's the same reason, buses run on schedules. I mean, ideally you would just walk down to the transportation, platform and get where you wanted to go. But like when you're talking about a shared resource, you need limitations around it to make sure that service is uniform. And maybe that means that service is not, it's not the transportation platform, but you get where you need to go. And if you do some planning around it, you have access to what you need.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I do have a couple of $1,000 of credits for Azure. What I should probably do is just, I'll just make a back end. It'll cache the Twit API so that anyone can hit it. But what I'll do is I'll set it so that once it runs out, once I've used up all the money, it will just shut off. And that's a really good way to do it, because you'll get upset at the other guy who hit the API way too much. It really is a matter of fairness. I'm not making fun of anyone out there who wants to write an app. Lou, maybe we should show people how to make a back end, because it's not that hard to cache the data. I mean, you gave us some of the major first steps, how to go through the entire inventory of a show and get all the JSON blobs that you need so you have all of the information available for you. It's relatively trivial to make that information available outside, especially making an API of an API cache.
Yeah, I mean, we should definitely do that. I think it would be a great task to show, like, you could do it in AWS or Azure, like you were saying, you get some free credits there when you sign up, and you could show how, some of these backend, these key value pairing databases nowadays, Redis and some of these other ones, you can store blobs as JSON and it's easy to query. And then with, something like Azure Mobile Services, it's just a couple clicks and checkboxes to generate an API off of it. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it would be kind of cool to kind of go through that whole scenario for everybody to see how to make that middleware for your app.
All right.
My colleague and cohort, Matt Grill, on this project, on the Twit project, has actually released the front end, a model of the front end called Saucier that powers Twit, which is the Dust and Node system, which hooks into Redis, which is a caching system. And you could use that to hook up to the Twit API. You'd basically have the Twit, the basics of the Twit front end, at least the consuming technologies, you know, in your hands tonight if you wanted. And that's Saucier, and that you can find links to that on the forward.4kitchens.com website. It's a Node.js and Dust.js.
So you're basically caching the API. I like the Saucier.
Saucier, yeah. And so actually the front end of Twit, the actual website, the node, it caches just like, so basically everyone is saying, well, you know, I don't, you know, I just want to be able to hit the API. The website is actually caching.
That's right.
It is doing exactly what y'all are saying. It's caching these results because it's just way faster to have that information at hand than it is to go ahead and make the network traffic trip out to the API to get it. So, you know, we're caching for performance and availability. So Twit's website is doing the exact same thing that everyone else will do or should do or could do. Yeah,
it makes so much more sense to have the local data cache because it's a lot easier to access than have to go make a request to Twit through Threescale and then get the data back. And yeah, it makes so much more sense.
Well, how about that? Let me promise you that we're going to have David back at some point because we do want to show you how to do this. I mean, it's not hard, but it's also not entirely trivial. There's a little bit that you have to understand about how you set it up, including which provider you're going to use, because you're obviously not going to want to host this out of your house. You're going to want to pick a nice cloud provider that can give you some cheap computing time and some cheap storage. But that actually might be fun, and I am serious about that. If I remember, I will build a back end and I'll put it up on Azure and I'll just let it run until it runs out of money. So yeah, there we go. David, is there any little extra tidbits? We're running out of time here, but that you would like the Coding 101 audience to know about the Twit API, about what went into it, or maybe some tricks that they should take into account when they build their client?
Yeah, I would go to, if you don't know about the APIary site, it's sort of the documentation for the API, and it's at, I'll bring it over here, it's at docs.twit.tv.apiary.io. You can sign in with GitHub. It is all of the documentation about the API. There's a lot of textual information describing how the different endpoints behave, but you can actually use this as a mock API. So if whatever's in, you apply for and an API key and it takes 2 or 3 days because human beings are approving these things and you just can't wait, you can actually use APIary to serve up API results. And you can build your app to these results because they're the exact same kind of result format that you'll get from the API. So you can build your API consumer without any access to the API whatsoever. If you just want to play with it and see how it acts, you know, APIary will serve that up. So that's one trick. We really love this tool. It was instrumental. It allowed us to kind of decouple our workflows. You know, we created the API and then the front-end team could start implementing against it and the back-end team could start designing the API to produce the API that we designed here. So number one trick. And other tricks, I would say, just to go back to these, you know, actually, and Lou had talked about this just off camera, I guess, which was or on camera. You guys are live all the time. This is kind of great. But you can find a lot of connections between data in these different items by going to the, you know, physically the bottom of a piece of information and looking at the links, which are the relationships. And so kind of exploring those links gives you like high value things that like Patrick was talking about, sort of like, how many for this person, what are all the shows that they were in for this episode, what are all the credits? Yeah, so basically my credit is 59196, and so I want to go to episodes, show me all the episodes that I was actually credited in, show me all the shows that I was actually in. So these are really rich spaces and ways to connect data that might not be, you know, particularly obvious immediately. So those are the two tricks that I would sort of like tell people to kind of investigate and to get real value out of.
Fantastic. David Deers, engineer, musician, all-around cool guy from Four Kitchens. We want to thank you for helping us with this module. We've been promising our folks some inside information on the TWID API, how it came about, why it was created the way it was. And I hopefully you've given our audience a little bit of food for thought. Now, I want to give you your time here. Could you please tell us where they can find you, where they can find your work, Four Kitchens, and, of course, where they can find your music? And I promise that we'll drive everyone to your sites as we possibly can.
Well, thank you so much. And I really appreciate you all inviting me to come to these past two episodes. And I just really appreciate having a chance to speak with you all. It's been a lot of fun. And these things go by really fast is all I got to say.
Tell me about it.
where did the time go? You know. But I'm David Deers. I'm on Twitter at @beautyhammer. I am on the internet at fourkitchens.com. That's my company. You can find our Rest Easy blog series, which is talking about the technology, the Drupal technology that drives the API, at fourword.fourkitchens.com. And that series is a weekly series updated on Monday. You can go to our GitHub location and find Saucier, which is Matt Grill's consuming Node.js server technology that serves the twit.tv website. So please go there. We also are offering a training in DrupalCon Europe. If you're in Europe and enjoying this, please go to that training and sign up. You can find my music at daviddeers.com, DIERS.com. You can also link to my YouTube from there and my Facebook page. So please follow me or friend me or like me or listen and let me know what you think. That'd be great.
And remember, the next time you are in the Bay Area, we do have quite a few cameras and microphones here. So if you wanted to record some music in a professional environment, this might be a good place to do it.
I would love that.
David Deers, we'll have you back on real soon. Thank you very much. Of course, I have to thank my co-hosts here, starting with Mr. Patrick Delahanty, who you've been screwing up the camera angles for 4 weeks because I am like a foot
I'm
and
too
a half
tall.
Shorter than you. Could you please tell the folks where they can find you, where they can find your work, and where they can find the work of your wife?
They can find links to all my stuff on my horrible-looking website at adequate.com. Hopefully by the time this episode is out, I'll have it redesigned because I realized how horrible it is.
Will it have an API?
I won't have an API. Oh. It's just going to be linking to my other stuff like adequate.com. Go buy my wife's book. It's called Awkward. You can find it in bookstores everywhere and online. Awkward by Svetlana Chimakova. It's a graphic novel aimed for tweens, like 10 to 13-ish. And it's got great reviews. So, there it is. Go check it out.
I have a copy on my desk that's still waiting for an autograph. But
limited edition hardcover. It's also paperback and Kindle. So enjoy.
Awkward. And, of course, the Lou Monster, Mr. Lou Maresca, senior lead at Microsoft. Could you please tell people where they can find you and your work?
Absolutely. You can always find me on Twitter at LouMM. And, of course, all my work that I do at Microsoft on a daily basis is found at crmdynamics.com.
And don't forget that we do this show every Wednesday. Every Wednesday at 2:30, you'll get a new release of Coding 101. Sometimes it's live. Sometimes it's not. This particular one is not. But if you go to live.twit.tv, you'll be able to see the pre-show, the post-show, everything in between. It's part of the experiment that is Twit TV. It's not just a content channel. It's kind of a family. Also, if you're going to watch live, jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv. It's a great way for you to give us feedback. And I do pull questions. If you've got questions to the guests, if you've got topics you want covered, it's a great way to interact with us during the shows. Finally, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Of course, to Lisa and to Leo for letting us do Coding 101. And to my TD of the day, you may know this guy. You know, he's been around a little bit. We call him the Cranky Hippo. Brian Burnett, could you tell the folks where they can find you on the Twit TV network?
Well, as I don't have a camera on me, I'll just leave it on the wide. You can find me at about.me/Brian Burnett. And doing know-how with you, Padre. Yeah.
Or twitter.com/CrankyHippo.
At @Cranky_Hippo.
Until next time, I am Father Robert Ballester. This right here is Patrick Delahanty. That guy up in the screen over here, that's Lou Maresca. And, of course, that was David Deers, but he's not supposed to be here right now. He's incognito. This has been Coding 101. And, Lou, what do we say?
End of line.